Rewind, your year in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
This is Rewind, but not any Rewind. This is the Year in Review Rewind. These are the 15 top stories from J.R. Ross at WisPolitics and Wisconsin Eye, and we're going to count them down, and we've asked our house band, a house drummer, Henry Cerugi, to join us as we usually do. So stay with us as we look at the top 15 stories of 2017. Quite a year, J.R.
Yeah, it was kind of quiet.
All right, let's start with honorable mentions. Ron Johnson and his rising profile in the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, I mean, during his first six-year term in the Senate, he was kind of a quiet presence. I mean, he had his kind of causes when it came to repealing the Affordable Care Act, the debt, and the deficit. But he really, after winning re-election, and quite honestly, without much help from Washington, D.C., he became kind of emboldened to be a little bit more of a outspoken force in the caucus. He raised concerns about the health care bill and said, you got to change these things to get me on board. He said, the tax bill, I need to have these changes to get on board. In the end, he voted for these things, but he kind of raised some noise on the process and kind of became more of a force.
Did he raise his profile because he has announced this will be his second and final term, do you think?
Well, a couple of things. One, he's beholden to nobody in Washington, D.C. I mean, if you go back and look the final month and a half of his race, it was him spending money and one kind of group in Wisconsin helping him out. The Mitch McConnell did not come help Ron Johnson last month until about a week out they went, holy smokes, there's a chance here he can win this thing. And the money came pouring in. So he doesn't owe Mitch McConnell anything or these other groups came and spent money for him. He kind of won on his own in his mind. Yeah. So he's like, hey, you know, I can do what I want to do.
Okay. Honorable mention, high-capacity wells. This is a big deal in the Central Sands area.
Especially because this bill fell apart in the closing days of last session. And Scott Fitzgerald, in his early interviews for 2017, said, we're going to get this done right away. Ended up striking a deal to get it done. This is a big deal for farmers in Central Sands.
And the ag industry, the vegetables.
Potato farmers, those kinds of things. It also is a big deal to environmentalists because they're saying, look, we are seeing these waterways, these lakes drying up because we got too many straws in the drink. Yeah. We keep pulling out water. Something's going to happen. Look at these lakes that have, you know, docks hundreds of feet from where the water is now. What's going on? There is a study that was included in that bill to look at Central Sands specifically and see what might be happening, but it's still a concern for environmentalists looking at that bill.
Yeah, and you've seen an explosion of high-capacity wells, and this bill, we ought to be clear, it allows them to be rebuilt and sold without formal overview from DNR.
And DNR can't consider the impact from other wells looking at these things.
Huge deal. Okay, honorable mention, the two GOP candidates, Senator Leah Vukmir and Mr. Nicholson, have found big money partners.
Mm-hmm. So we won't really know how the Nicholson and Vukmir campaigns are doing on their own until January, our first real taste, because we got a slight taste of what they're doing with their third quarter reports, but they weren't full quarters. Tammy Baldwin is in a fundraising sphere by herself in this race so far. So for Nicholson and Vukmir, I don't know they can ever catch up to Baldwin, but these backers, Dick Uihlein for Kevin Nicholson, from Beloit, Diane Hendricks for
Leah,
they may be able to help make up the difference through their super PACs. And we already saw in the fall like $2.3 million in ads for Nicholson from outside groups. That helped boost his name ID. His campaign put out a poll saying that he's actually in the lead among likely Republican primary voters. We'll see if that all holds up, but you're definitely seeing spending happening to move his name ID. The question becomes in 2018, how they do on their own, and what's the response going to be from the pro-Vukmir super PAC to maybe balance things out.
Senator Baldwin, though, she will be a national cause to be reelected. She will be well-funded, don't you think, JR?
Especially if you're looking at, you know, the environment in 2018, and I hesitate to make any predictions about 2018 because what happened in 2016, but if you're looking at seats that are vulnerable that Dems could win, you'll think Baldwin's in a good position. She's well-funded. She has a national fundraising network. Wisconsin still has been a purplish state. I mean, it went red in 2016, obviously, but we're anticipating a snapback against the White House. So we're not like a Montana or in Indiana or a place where Trump won by, you know, a dozen, or North Dakota, 15, 20 points. We're talking about less than a point, or point one that he won by in Wisconsin. That's still a swing state. So she's going to be definitely somebody who gets help because there's a chance to win here.
Okay, honorable mention, Reince Priebus. Now, you and I watched his career. Mm-hmm. He ran against Senator Wirch in Kenosha, became state chairman, becomes national chairman with the help of our GOP committee man and committee woman and Speaker Ryan, and his old college roommate, Mr. Boss. Yeah. And then he's chief of staff, and then a few months later, he's not chief of staff.
I mean, it's interesting. This is a guy who lost a Senate campaign, granted in a Democratic-leaning seat.
Yeah, in Kenosha.
But in a year where Republicans thought they had the issues down there. I remember that race where they came out of that and went, how do we lose a race when we had property taxes as our number one issue? Fast forward, he's now one of the leading Republican figures in, you know, a little more than a decade. That's kind of an amazing ascension for him. But the Trump White House was such a kind of a frantic pace. All the stories about him were about how he was running from meeting to meeting, sprinting down the hallways, trying to intercept people going to the Oval Office. It was a pace that looked to be sustainable, and he never seemed to kind of have the president's confidence.
Right.
It's interesting. You know, he's back now with Michael Best, his old law firm, not lobbying, but doing, you know, government-type stuff. He landed on his feet, but it was an interesting rise and then sudden fall because, remember, he found out he got his can, basically, like, from social media. Yeah. They came back from this trip on the tarmac. He climbs in one of the black SUVs with other aides, and all of a sudden they get out. He's by himself, and the black SUV kind of drives off with Reince Priebus away from the other folks. It was kind of an amazing fall for him, but also kind of an interesting rapid rise and quick fall.
Yeah, and both of you are both of us are trying to get interviews with Reince Priebus on his amazing year. Okay, honorable mention, Tony Evers wins, I think, his third statewide office.
This tells you how busy 2017 was, that the first time a left-of-center or Democrat won a meaningful statewide race in a while in Wisconsin, other than, you know, Tammy Baldwin and Barack Obama in 2012, is an honorable mention. But Evers ran a great campaign. He had very flawed candidates to run against that struck this weird deal, or they talked about this weird deal of, if I win, you get this. If you win, I get this. It really never took off. And also now is a springboard for Evers to run for governor. I mean, he can talk about how he's the only Dem to win statewide since 2012, other than Doug La Follette, who's not really a top-of-the-ticket type race. He raised money statewide for a campaign, been up on the air, been in public office for, you know, more than, or closing on a decade. I mean, those are all good things for him to sell in this environment. But still, crowded field. He didn't scare anybody out of the field when he got in.
No, that's right. Okay, now we go to the top 10. So, House Band, take us into number 10, the saga of David Clark. The Milwaukee County Sheriff finally leaves, gets on his horse and the cowboy hat, the leather, and leaves. I'm not quite clear on where he went, but the last rally for Judge Roy Moore, Steve Bannon and David Clark up on the stage. You want to talk about the saga ending of Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark?
Look at the arc of, in the 2016 presidential race, he was an early and prominent surrogate for Donald Trump. So we all assumed once Trump won that there would be a place in the administration for David Clark.
Yep.
And it took forever, it seemed like, until something broke. Then all of a sudden, he goes on a conservative talk show in the spring and says, I'm going to go be an assistant secretary over at Department of Homeland Security. Okay? There's his landing spot. But then there was nothing from the department.
No formal offer.
And all of a sudden, Father's Day weekend in June, I get an email on a late Saturday afternoon after coaching baseball or watching baseball, and it says, I've rescinded that opportunity. Well, what the heck is going on?
Which never formally came.
And now you talk to the Clark people, I'll tell you, it was all lined up. Everything was there, but something happened that he was never got it. And oh, by the way, along the way, there were reports about the county jail and the deaths in the county jail that he was running, a deficit with his agency, constant conflicts with Chris Abley, county executive. I mean, all
of
these things.
And he might have plagiarized to get some additional credential.
Oh, and once he got in the national spotlight, the glare became very intense for him. And then all of a sudden, he announces he's resigning, you know, late summer. He's leaving the sheriff's office. He's now apparently working with a pro-Trump organization, and we're seeing him pop up with Trump stuff. He's still on Fox News regularly talking about the president. I'm sure if you look at, he had a disclosure statement about the money he made off of speeches. He's doing quite well in the speaking circuit, I'm going
to
guess.
And Milwaukee County taxpayers had to pay rather steeply to guard he and his family. Okay, mm-hmm. let's close number 10 by listening to an interview that Sheriff Clark gave, and then Chris Abley on questioning his leadership. Let's go to that short video.
The illegal immigration is a crisis in this country. Most of the people in Washington don't want to touch it. It's kind of like that third rail. But President Trump decided and has told us he's going to lead this country. He's going to get his arms around this thing, even though he knows it's going to come without that, you know, with that struggle. So this is a crisis. This has to be rectified. There's numerous reasons why we need to protect the border. We have some national security issues, domestic security issues. We have drugs pouring in across our southern border. Also, you want to be able to protect public health. Remember the Ebola outbreak? Well, we started doing that overseas and at the border. And then there are also, you want to control the amount of immigrants coming into the, refugees coming into the country, because it's a strain on our limited resources. And so that's why you have to have a border. We're a sovereign nation. And if you have that border, you must protect that border and defend that border. And right now, it's pretty porous.
Sheriff Clark, do you expect him to finish his term?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, functionally, he hasn't viewed Milwaukee County Sheriff as sort of a full-time job in some time. He's not around, certainly in the building and often in the county, an awful lot. He hasn't been an active manager for a while. I mean, every year I've been here, his budget has deficited. You know, regardless of somebody's politics or personality, if you ask to voters to put you in office, it is reasonable for them to hold you accountable for actually serving in that office. The tone of some of his remarks publicly has been, he kind of thinks he's bigger than Milwaukee. He seems like he's burned an awful lot of bridges. He's got these ongoing investigations into deaths at the jail. He's got the biggest deficit he's had this year. You know, I'm not really sure what the incentive would be for him, but I guess we'll see.
House Band, take us into number 9. Oh, we're doing the brushes. Okay, changes on the state Supreme Court. Justice Gableman says he won't seek re-election, and Annette Ziegler was re-elected. Big changes?
Well, possibly. First was Ziegler. Remember that coming out of the 2016 election, Democrats were dispirited and, like, downcast. So Ziegler drew no opponent, which was, you know, unusual for a 10-year term of the court.
Yeah.
But the thinking was they just got their butts kicked in 2016. How do you go ask for money and really run a strong campaign in that environment? Well, little did we know that the Trump snapback would begin almost immediately. There was a resistance that kind of popped up around the country. And April turned into a pretty good election for Democrats. That also leads a question with Tony Evers as was there interplay that because there was no organized kind of conservative effort on the ballot in April, did that help Evers win easily in his campaign? So move beyond that. Now, Gableman says not seeking re-election. He had been kind of queued up to be a big target for Democrats, progressives, because in the last race he ran in 28, he ran this very controversial ad.
Against Justice Butler? The African-American justice?
He's drawn all kinds of criticism, so he was going to be a target. After he announced he wasn't going to seek re-election, word came that he's being vetted for a job in the Trump administration. Now, we don't know much about what it is, other than it's not a judicial appointment. So it's also interesting that the Trump administration has a very poor job of filling vacancies in the administration, but an excellent job filling vacancies in the courts. So now Gableman's up for this job, which leads to the next question of, will he leave before his term is up? And if he does, that mean that Governor Walker can appoint somebody to the spot? Well, we assume Michael Schrank, who is the conservative candidate in the Surrey primary for the court.
Former legal advisor to the governor.
Would be in line for that appointment. He's running against Tim Burns in the primary, a Middleton attorney.
And Milwaukee
Rebecca
County.
Dallett.
Yeah. She's a Milwaukee County judge.
What's interesting is to watch that primary develop is that Dems feel energized right now, and 2018 will be an early test, the April ballot, an early test of much energy they have. Two, Tim Burns is running a very different campaign than we used to see in the Supreme Court. Most of the time when I interview Supreme Court candidates, they'll say I can't comment on X, Y, and Z because
it's either a pending issue before the court or it could be coming before the court.
Tim Burns has had no qualms about saying I'm a progressive, these are my beliefs, this is what I stand for. Now, there are limits what you can say as a judge. You can't like say I'm going to vote this way on a case, right? But Burns says, I know where that line is, and I walk right up to it, essentially.
He does.
But he says here's the morality of his campaign to say where he stands. The question becomes, do voters like that? Two, we've been through this kind of conditioning in Wisconsin where voters want a judge for the Supreme Court, right? Burns is not a judge. However, we saw in the last contested race in 2016, three-way primary, there is really a difficult lane for a moderate in a three-way primary because you have a liberal, a conservative, and a moderate. How, as a moderate, do you run that race? It's going to be interesting to watch those kind of two competing forces played against each other in February.
And Justice Daniel Kelly was not a judge when he was appointed to a vacancy.
But he was appointed, and it gives him several years on the court to kind of get that judicial experience before he runs, which is much different than coming out of, you know, the legal community as a lawyer and running for a spot.
Right. Okay. Henry, take us to number eight, please. Assembly Dems make a change. Mm-hmm. They oust Democratic leader Peter Barker from Kenosha, who'd been, two tenures in the Assembly. He'd been their leader for 6 years, I think, since Cruiser left, and they replaced him with Gordon Hintz. Now, I think, J.R., this was an issue. Assembly Democrats finally got tired of Barker's leadership style, which said, I need to control everything, which delayed decision-making. They grew frustrated. And then finally, Mr. Barker voted for Foxconn, which we'll get to later, which was that the tipping point for Assembly Dems?
I was told that was not the issue. That was a brick in the wall of the case against Peter Barker. But look at what's happened in 12, 14, 16 in the elections. They did not pick up seats. They are now in the smallest minority they've had since 1957.
34.
Now, the environment played a great deal in that. The maps played a great deal in that. But the complaint has been that Barker didn't get them out, make any progress on closing that gap in the time. And the thing I heard a lot was, he was better at maintaining his job as minority leader than he was at leading the minority to, you know, gains. So now they picked Gordon Hintz. Hintz, who was cited in a massage parlor sting, who yelled an expletive, you're blank and dead, at a female Republican lawmaker in the Act 10 debate, and now is the leader of the caucus. They said the baggage is not a big deal because they see him as a more aggressive type leader who is going to have a plan to get out, not just to lead the minority on the floor, but lead out of the minority.
But Hintz got elected because he promised to share some of the decision making and to branch out some of that. Okay,
that definitely helped.
Number seven, can you lead us in with the theme song for the Speaker of the House?
No.
Okay, well, give us your best effort. Number seven, the trials and tribulations of Paul Ryan. I want to offer four things. First of all, he's the Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. He has to deal with a president who tweets. Yep. That hasn't happened before. He wanted to repeal Obamacare. That didn't happen. He's going to get tax code changes passed, but he ends the year walking off at a press conference saying, no, I'm not going anywhere. So talk to me about the year Mr. Ryan had.
He got his major career-long goal was overhauling the tax code. So he got that. But along the way, what price did he pay with how he kept the caucus together, dealt with the president, and it led to a story in Politico magazine and the Huffington Post saying, he may walk away after
quoting 16 sources.
Now, he has said that's not true. He's not going to walk away. It makes no sense. So we'll see. We have 2018 to figure that out, right? But here's a guy who didn't want the job in the first place, kind of like said, well, I've got to take it and because nobody else can, and hasn't let people forget, I took it because nobody else could.
Right.
So there are definitely wings of his caucus who aren't very appreciative of the speaker's effort. But again, he got his major, major career-long goal is tax overhaul.
Yep.
Now, the next thing he wants to do, entitlements.
Entitlement reform, which is Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and we'll see how that goes.
President Trump ran in 2016 saying, we will not touch Social Security. So how's that going to work with that? And oh, by the way, the argument already is kind of percolating from Republicans of, we have to deal with these things because of the deficit. Democrats go, wait a second, why'd you pass a tax bill that adds to the deficit if you cut out the deficit?
Right. Right.
That's Washington.
So Mr. Ryan is going to end the year with a big win on tax code changes. And here's a very short snippet on how he talks about why those changes are needed.
The rest of the world that we compete with, they tax their businesses on average at 22.5%. What we're proposing is drop these tax rates on these businesses by 40% across the board so that we're taxing our businesses at or below the industrialized average. If you want to make something in America, we don't want the tax code to penalize you for making that decision. We want the tax code to encourage you to make that decision to make things here in America.
Our next one is the governor seeking a third term. Was that hail to the chief or hail to the governor? Okay. Number six, Governor Walker announces he'll be seeking a third term. 16 Democrats are now registered. JR, when I look, the governor won in 2010 with 1.2 million votes. Mm-hmm. Then in the recall, he got 200,000 more votes, 1.33. 2014, he was reelected with 1.25 million. This guy has been able to hold his base together, and it's going to be up to the Democrats may have a tough row to take him out.
Well, we always thought the lesson in Wisconsin was that the higher turnout was, the better it was for Democrats. Walker disproved that the 2012 recall election, and then Donald Trump disproved that, and Ron Johnson in 2016, they could win with 3 million people turning out to vote. So that's, you know, good for Walker. The question kind of becomes, how much damage is left over from his run for president? Has the base come back to embrace him? What will the environment be like in 2018? Because running Scott Walker, he's never run into headwinds. He's always run the wind at his back. He's run statewide in 10, 12. We didn't know it at the time, but realized later on that people don't like the idea of recalling somebody because of a decision made. Now, ethical problem, legal stuff, different story. But just because the guy made a decision on Act 10, in the voters' minds, wasn't the reason to recall him, right? 14, GOP wave. Now, in 18, if, and I want to stress, if things hold as they are right now, he's going to have a headwind. He's got the Republican in the White House, and it looks like a possibly very bad year for Republicans. How will Scott Walker run that environment? Now, a bonus for him, or a plus for him, is the Democratic field is so fractured right now,
yes.
You know, with the people. And you look at that list, maybe 8-ish. You know,
serious
candidates right?
Viable financially and in terms of holding some office.
We will find out in January how they did raising money. We'll find out then if Paul Soglin actually gets in the race. We may get a better idea if that field's going to narrow or widen, because if nobody's really taken a hold of it, you may see somebody else jump in and say, hey, these guys don't have much of a head start on me. I'm going to get in now.
Okay.
So that'll play out, but that fractured primary could help Walker. If they emerge from the August primary bruised, battered, and without a whole lot of money, that helps
Walker.
And
the winner gets 21% is what you're saying.
Well, that's also the other part of the equation. They're all looking and saying, hey, Bernie Sanders won his very progressive campaign in Wisconsin in 2016, won the Democratic primary, won every county but one in Wisconsin in winning that primary. They're thinking, if I can win that primary with the environment that we're going to see in 2018, anything is possible. And that might be true.
Okay. Let's take a listen and a look at Scott Walker feeling it when he announced his third bid, his bid for a third term, this is how it sounded.
I'm pleased. I am thrilled on behalf of our outstanding Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish and I to announce today that Rebecca and I are asking for 4 more years to serve as your governor and Lieutenant Governor to move Wisconsin forward. You know, as much as you look at our record and you think, boy, more jobs than ever before, more people employed in this state than ever before, historic levels of investments in K-12 education, freezing tuition at all of our UW campuses to make it more affordable for students and working families, looking at ways that we put more people to work and drop their welfare rolls, looking at the quality of our health care, all these things suggest that this should be a relatively easy reelection. But let me tell you, it's not going to be. The big government special interest in Washington, they've already made us a target in this election. I'm asking for independents and Democrats and anyone else out there because I need your votes to keep moving this state forward because there's more to be done.
Before we go to number 5, you have a quick P.S. on Walker?
I hate making predictions, but I can bet you money. You'll hear a couple of things from Governor Walker, the campaign trail in 2018. Eliminate state property tax, a quote-unquote historic investment in K-12 education, and there's more to do in terms of improving the state's economy, and Foxconn. He's going to run that deal that he brought this Taiwanese manufacturer to Wisconsin, and that has a potential of 13,000 jobs at the plant plus more. That's going to be a big part of his campaign going forward.
Okay. Henry, here's a challenge. Number 5. It hasn't been written yet, but give us the intro to a song called The Ghost of John Doe's. Number 5. JR, where do we start? The Attorney General just released a report that is continuing to roll through the Capitol in all different ways. And he finds a John Doe 3, and he finds a gross mishandling of documents in John Doe 1, John Doe 2, John Doe 3, and there was an investigation into campaigning on state time. deja vu, goes back to the caucus scandal. And then that leads the Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald and Speaker Voss to call for the resignation of Mike Haas, Interim Director of the Elections Commission, and Brian Bell, Administrator of the Ethics Commission. And now we learned, since we taped last Rewind, Fitzgerald says, I'm going to vote to turn them out of office in January if they don't resign. So, okay, that's me on the Schimmel report and the fallout. Your take.
A couple things. One, that when Schimmel put out this report, there was a feeling from people in the Capitol that he was trying to kind of bring this hammer down on the entire old GAB, right? Schimmel's up for election in 2018. The GOP base does not care for the old GAB. There's still some resentment there because of what service went through that entire process. So the feeling was, okay, he's dropping the hammer to kind of like give a little nod to these groups saying, hey, you know, here you go. We couldn't get him through these various federal lawsuits that were filed by Club for Growth folks. We couldn't get him at the ballot box, but we're going to get him by showing how incompetent this whole thing was and ask for contempt charges against proceedings.
Yes.
It's nine people.
Yes.
Ever since that report came out, it has been pushback after pushback and then counter pushback about the details in there. First, the Ethics Commission saying, no, these things aren't right, that these are, we're going to ask for receive clarifications. And Schimmel said, no, you know, we weren't wrong. Then you had others saying, no, this isn't right. And then the whole question of, was it a John Doe 3 or not? John Doe is a secret investigation that is different from a GAB investigation, the old GAB. They're both secret, but done a little bit differently. There's a report saying it wasn't actually a John Doe, it was a GAB probe, and Schimmel says, no, it's related to John Doe too. You know, I'm not a lawyer, I can't say for sure what happened, but there are also these errors in the report, like simple ones, like Dan Bice is a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There was a story in the Journal Sentinel about a DOJ visit to the court to go look at records. Mm-hmm. The paper reported it. Schimmel seemed to suggest that, well, Bice's wife worked in the court, ergo that's why it got out. By saying, no, my wife left before that. So what's going on?
Many months before that.
And then this other thing is, in the John Doe 3, let's just use, you know, the DOJ words for it, John Doe 3, there were 36 Republican aides, operatives, and then State Senator Leo Vukmir who were on that list. There are Republicans in the Capitol who are not happy that Brad Schimmel put their names in the public sphere. So when they go to a job interview, they say, oh, yeah, by the way, my name's in there because of X. So that was kind of thing that kind of blew up on a little bit. So it kind of a little bit of a rough end of the report for him.
Okay. Yeah, and it's interesting because going forward, will Mr. Haas resign because he's now backed by the commission? And he says he won't. Will Brian Bell resign? Or will Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald formally bring, which I think the legislative attorney is saying would end their jobs, running the elections commission as we start a major election year. So.
What's interesting is for conservatives, they thought giving the GAB would get rid of a lot of these problems. The issue they've come to realize is that they don't trust the staff. And once you don't trust the staff, there's going to be this issue. Mike Haas is a holdover. A lot of these guys are holdovers from the old GAB. That distrust still exists. Now my question is, how do you fix that? How do you get to a point where you bring in people who are competent, running elections and ethics rules, that can be trusted to do that and are somehow clean of all this who aren't partisans?
That's a good point. Okay, your next charge, theme song for the U.S. Supreme Court. Ready? Number four, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether the reapportionment, the redistricting lines drawn in 2011, up or down. I understand they haven't ruled yet, JR, but this is a huge deal, and that's why it's number four.
Well, I think it's based on potential. I mean, if they uphold the maps, this thing drops off the list.
I agree, and we'll drop it from the list next year.
But if they redraw the maps, you're talking about the possibility of, one, how is the legislature going to redraw these maps with these new standards? Because the problem has been with gerrymandering cases for a long time with this country is there is no agreed-upon standard that a court could say, okay, it violated this standard by X, therefore you have to do this and this and this to fix it. This case could, for the first time in our nation's history, set a standard to guide all maps by.
A political standard, because the other standard have been whether it's discriminated against minorities.
That also means that maps in all 50 states can be challenged via this standard going forward. It's not just about Wisconsin, it's about everybody after this. So if that happens, if they have to draw them, one, the three-judge panel had set a deadline for the law legislature to draw the maps. The Supreme Court put that on hold. There could be a rush to draw maps now. Let's be honest. They are so good now, the programs that they have, they can draw a map.
It's a computer thing.
In no time.
Do it. Algorithms, diggy.
But once that map is drawn, guess what's going to happen? It will be looked at and held against that standard. And I'm assuming they overturn the maps. Held against that standard. Now I'm talking about time crunch. It is, you know, late December. What happens when
they rule in May or June?
Now maybe you go April 1st, you start circulating, June 1st, they're due. That is a tight window if you don't know where you're going to run in August. Now, if the court says these maps are valid, we can't find, there's no justifiable standard for a political gerrymander in this country,
yeah,
no big deal. It all goes away. Dems complain. They win the ballot box to have a seat at the table for redistricting 2021. But if they overturn it, that's a tidal wave.
But when Schimmel sat in that chair 2 weeks ago in a year-end review, he said the people challenging the Wisconsin lines have not given the court a universal standard that could be used, as you just said, for all 50 states. So he's predicting the states win, but that's a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Henry, number three is our troubled juvenile prisons. I want to hear this. Okay, thanks. Lincoln Hills and the Women's Juvenile Facility continue to be plagued by major problems. We're talking about children here, mm-hmm. albeit they've been convicted of some serious crimes. But you have violent incidents. You have a federal investigation that's now gone into its third year. And Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake is mm-hmm. still not fixed. Now, this, I think, is going to be a big issue in the gubernatorial campaign. But what's your take on number three?
Politically, you know, Walker has said, I am not going to go up there to visit. That'll be an interesting thing to watch.
He's never visited a prison.
The line has come up from his administration that and Schimmel, that when a judge steps in and orders changes at a prison, it's dangerous because he or she is not well-versed in how a prison is run. There's that issue. And then what else pops up? I mean, we have not seen this conclusion of this investigation. What charges are filed, if any? What changes are made? Do they have a handle on it yet? Now, there are also, you know, people talking about whether they should close these facilities. Let's be honest, a lot of the folks are up there from the Milwaukee area. This is way far away from Milwaukee. I'm not an expert in corrections, but what I've read tells me that if you're isolated from family, that's a problem. They closed youth prison closer to Milwaukee some years ago.
Ethan Allen.
What are they going to do? You know, what's the next step? At some point, there has to be a resolution to this that is a fix that'll work.
Right, and that's why we're going to listen to Corrections Secretary John Litcher talking about the changes that have been made. But then you had a legislative delegation, Representative Michael Schra, Representative Evan Goyke, that went there, talked to the staff. So it's still a huge issue. Let's listen to some of the segments summarizing the problem at our state's juvenile prison.
But in all honesty, I am sitting in front of you today differently than possibly some other individual who would have the privilege of addressing your concerns and your issues, because of the concerns that have been identified at Lincoln Hills Copper Lakes. Because I'm here to say to you, first and foremost, that Lincoln Hills Copper Lakes is a safe and secure environment for the youth that we're serving there. The issues that have been well reported on were issues in the past, from my perspective. But I'm here to say to you that under new leadership, that has changed.
One of the individuals that was restrained behind doors looked at us and I believe his question was, why are you here? And I said, we want to make the place better. And he said, do you want to make it better for the guards or for us? And I said, for both.
I think the public, because of all of the coverage of this facility, thinks that this is, on a daily basis, so chaotic, and that's just not true. That's just simply not true. That doesn't mean that the facility is effective. Just because we didn't watch a fist fight happen doesn't mean that it's working. The staff told me that morale is still as low as it's ever been, that the challenge of getting up every day, the person I was talking to started working at 10:30 the night before and was going to get off in the afternoon and then come right back in the next day. And we know this, the media has covered this, that when we put people in that situation, the tensions flare. It would happen to any of us.
I asked how morale was, and I got varying answers, actually. The reason I got that morale was low is because this overhanging investigation is still out there, and a lot of people are really walking on eggshells, I think, because the ACLU lawsuit, I think, put people on eggshells, and not knowing, you know, if they're able to react and protect other youth in the way that, you know, they feel are appropriate.
I'd like to see us work with counties that have already done something different other than sending their young people to Lincoln Hills, like Racine, and see what collaborative things we can do with them regionally. And very candidly, I'd like to see us redesign the Department of Corrections so that it is connected with juvenile corrections, so it's not connected with DOC, but instead connected with the Department of Children and Families.
For some instances, keeping Lincoln Hills open may be a viable alternative. I can't speak to just closing it all the way, but I can speak to bringing our students closer to home. It's something I've advocated before multiple times. I can't say that just closing the doors automatically, because then we're dealt with, we have a whole lot of students we have to figure out something for.
So primarily the kids who go to Lincoln Hills are from Milwaukee. So I have often asked myself, why is the entire state of Wisconsin paying for Milwaukee's issues in many ways, when if you're living in Racine or places like potentially Dane County, they've mostly done the program themselves to find a better way to solve the exact same problem. So, you know, I don't think we should just say politically, like Dana Wachs is saying, without real facts, that we should close it. But I certainly am open to exploring the idea of saying, why is it there? How is it done best? Why is the state subsidizing Milwaukee again, like we do constantly for things in the city of Milwaukee, without some kind of a long-range plan to at least find a way to get out of it?
Like transportation, where it's just not a priority for this governor. I mean, it's been in his lap. He was first notified by Racine in 2011. Lincoln Hills is at 70% vacancy right now. And so there are issues to raise if this is the best model, and counties like Racine are paying their own way because they don't want to refer them there. It doesn't seem to have any urgency. This governor's taken no responsibility, hasn't taken the visit that I just did there. You know, his staff was up there. And so until it becomes a priority for this administration, I don't see anything changing.
Okay, House Band, here's your challenge. Number two, the state budget and the two-month delay. I want to hear this. Thanks. The state budget is supposed to be passed by July 1. Mm-hmm. The transportation funding impasse held it up. It was signed into law by Governor Walker on September 21, played out in so many different dimensions. You had Walker kicking in an additional $648 over 2 years for K-12 aides. That was discussed by the Democrats as buying back cuts of the past years. But the whole transportation impasse, unresolved in a budget that passed. And then you have huge transportation issues in Racine County with Foxconn, which we'll get to pretty soon. So your take on the state budget impasse?
It kicked the can down the road. You know, I mean, let's be honest, when it comes to transportation. In 2015, we came out of that budget, Republicans saying, we will fix this next time. Well, the fix was going to be, and part of the foundation of this problem was, or standoff was, some Republicans saying, we have to have more money for roads, at least leadership saying that. And they offered a proposal, we will cut taxes other places to offset a gas tax increase. That should meet Governor Walker's, you know, tax pledge. But Governor Walker moved the goalposts on these guys, because originally it seemed like, okay, if we can offset it, maybe. And they said, nope, no fee hikes, no tax increase, period. So that kind of was part of the impetus for the standoff. And you have other Republicans saying, DOT has been so poorly mismanaged over the years that we can't give them any more money. This is kind of crazy. But then they got to fund the last leg of the zoo interchange, for example. They got to fund 94 North South. They got to fund this. They got to fund that. Where do you find the money? So I get the impression through the budget that the education stuff, they are, in the big picture, they are all same boat, right? Hey, politically, great thing. Pump money into schools. Yes, there's some disagreement about sparsity aid for local school districts because some Republicans wanted to allow them to raise property taxes. Walker said, no way. There are other things that, you know, got jammed in the budget, you know, late language kind of thing, like quarries that, you know, aggregate stone for road projects. He vetoed some stuff with that.
Yeah, he killed that.
But the transportation issue wasn't fixed, and if Walker wins re-election, won't get fixed next time. And if your fixes mean more money, because Governor Walker has said, basically, he's not going to raise taxes, period, because he's going to run for president again. You don't run for president as a tax raiser in the Republican primary. Now, they could find creative ways to finance roads. They could pull money from general purpose revenues in the transportation. There are all kinds of possibilities. But a long-term sustainable fix from the transportation fund by itself, it's on the cards right now.
And you and I have seen a lot of budgets, but for this one to end with the Speaker of the Assembly calling three Republican senators terrorists was just absolutely amazing to me.
And one of those terrorists, quote-unquote, is now on the Joint Finance
Committee. Senator Dewey Strobel is now on Joint Finance.
I have never in my career been in a news conference in the press room where one leadership team walked in and said, we're going to tear the shreds out of the other leadership team and walk out, and the other one came over the same room and said, okay, now it's our turn. In June, in the middle of the entire budget process, when the deadline was like a week away
right. Of
having it done, that was kind of interesting to watch. Now, the sausage making is never pretty. It never is in the budget. So put that aside. Republicans say, hey, we can run on, we got rid of the state property tax. We have, in their words, a historic investment in K-12 education. We've got income taxes that have been going down. We've got all these great things to sell. So to them, 6 months from now, will the public remember the ugly process to get there? No. Democrats can make the argument of this is an example of the lack of, in their words, right. A lack of leadership in the Capitol. They can't get along anymore. They can't get things done. Washington, D.C. has come to Wisconsin. Now, will that be a winning argument come November of next year? Because Democrats need to come out of the hole that they're in and start making a comeback. But the budget, it was the ugliest one I've covered so far, but I missed the late 90s with that transportation budget being done in October, I believe it was.
It was, yes. I was there, yes, yes.
So this one was something unique to watch.
Which is why I want, we're going to take a few minutes and look at the state budget debate. And it opened, this video is going to open with Speaker Voss saying, I've got a pair of twos, the governor has a straight, don't bet on me. And then you have Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald said, July 1 is my goal. Why did the speaker just say October? And by the way, the budget was signed on September 21. And the emotions increased, as you'll hear in this tape, in this video, covering about 6 months of budget debate.
If you are a card player, I have a pair of twos, the governor has a straight, and I have to draw three of a kind to win. Now, it's not impossible, but I wouldn't bet on me. But half of the state agrees that we've got a revenue problem, and the most politically unpopular is the gas tax. So if half the people are there on the gas tax, that means that a significant chunk are there, because we know that tolling, as my favorite, was already significantly higher than gas taxes in all the polling that we did. So I think most people have agreed we have a problem. Now we just have to have courage to actually solve it.
The speaker, I don't know why he said October yesterday. I think what he's kind of playing into it is that transportation piece. I mean, he's in a position right now where it sounds like he's going to hold tight, and that's fine. But I don't see this thing going beyond 1 July, so I just don't see it.
The governor's budget takes some steps to restore some education funding. The reality is we've just heard from schools that this will help them, stay afloat, and they're concerned that that commitment isn't going to be there in 2 years.
Basically, all the schools we've visited during the public hearings have been, smaller communities that have utilized the tools of Act 10, yet it kind of is a highlighting the issue, some of the issues that we still struggle with. So that's a focus of ours, to be able to make sure that all schools are providing the opportunity for our kids to succeed in the next, generation.
Obviously, we're pleased with the fact that the legislature chose to keep our budget for education as a base. We're also pleased with the recent news that suggests that the Finance Committee members are inclined to keep the dollar levels at or very similar to what we're proposing. We want to keep the pressure on, though, between now and the time the final budget is done, hopefully sometime later in June. Obviously, I'd made it consistent from day one that I didn't think we needed to raise the gas tax or the vehicle registration fee, and I remain consistent to that. We'll see what's ultimately in their proposal.
I'd be willing to get on a plane with Senator Fitzgerald and with Governor Walker to go to Washington to say to Speaker Ryan, let's get this done, And as soon as we get the option to toll, we'll pass a transportation bill.
It's going to cost us more to delay them than to borrow at the levels of borrowing right now. Plus, we need the infrastructure for our commerce to get people to work, to transport goods. It's vitally important for our economy.
I just know right now gas tax increase and vehicle registration increases is the caucus is not going to go along with it.
The question again was, how are we going to come up with a long-term funding solution? And I don't know, how did anybody in the Senate, Chairman Darling, how did, I mean, Milwaukee gets, I mean, the mega projects, how's your name on this motion? I mean, you got railroaded. You lost that two-month battle this summer, I'll tell you that. So I give you all an F, and we should try again.
Representative Hintz, you've been longer here than I have. Have you ever put a transportation package forward? You have not. You have not in your long career here. You have not tonight. There are reforms in this package that, over the course of the next decade, will save us hundreds of millions of dollars. But we also need to realize that our transportation needs are going to cost us billions of dollars.
Now, this isn't a unicorns and lollipop kind of thing. This is what we as legislators on both sides of the aisle are supposed to be doing. This should be our first official charge of business, is making sure our public schools are taken care of and they're strong. It's over $1.3 billion last year alone passed in referendums, because at least people at the local level understand the fact that they need, in order to give their kids the opportunity, they have to go out and raise money because the state is cutting them off at the knees.
I just cannot let these comments about racism and our policies and anti-teacher, it's very disturbing and it's not accurate. And I think sometimes your message is taken seriously by some people because we don't speak up and say that's not right. And I'm tired of it.
We still don't have an immediate, short-term, or long-term transportation solution. We've been waiting on y'all all summer. And this is what you came up with? F. Big F. That's what you get. Failure.
But I think it's because of that experience with so many of the immigrants who believed in our country and believed in our quality of life that I'm so much for this kind of a budget that does not rely on government but tries to have a climate for opportunity, for the development of small businesses, for people to know that if they work hard, they will be able to succeed.
This is a solid, sound budget. It allows us to protect public safety and public health while still protecting the local taxpayer. And invest big time in the student success for all of you, and invest for all of our citizens in being more digitally connected here and across the state, and invest in our roads and in our bridges, and invest in building a workforce for the jobs that we need, not just for today, but for tomorrow and far into the future.
JR, let's do a short PS on the budget. You and I are aware of the financial commitments that have been made to finance the Foxconn deal and to pay for the phase out of the state levy on the property on forestry tax. So they are sitting in a potential bind as they draft the 1921 budget, aren't
they? Well, it all depends on our growth and general purpose revenue. That is your income, sales, corporate taxes, excise taxes, a couple of small ones. But if we hit a recession, we're going to be in a big trouble because we've bought down the levy. So we have this mix of our taxes, right? You've got your sales, income, property. To lower the property tax, which is Governor Walker's obsession, we bought down levies on tech colleges, on schools.
And here's one, $48 million in general fund taxes to pay lottery profits, wins.
One of Governor Walker's big touting points of this budget is he eliminated the forestry tax. But again, they use GPR to buy it down. So I mentioned before about using GPR for transportation. If you want to go that route, you have all these pressures building that fund. If and when we hit a recession, because there's never been a time that I know of like continuous growth without like break, and we're at like year 10 of growth in this country, that recession hits and income drops, then we're going to be a world of hurt about how do you make up to be a lot of cuts to make that up.
That's
potentially.
Right. Okay, we're going to number one. So Henry, here's your charge. An ode to a Taiwan-based major high-tech company, take it. That was awesome. Number one, Foxconn. the investment went, let's talk about $3 billion in potential, 2.85 to the company, and $150 million in potential sales tax breaks. Local governments are chipping in more than $750. And now there were stories that you and I read, they're going to need a new electric generating plant, potential $140 million.
Transmission line. You've got the $140 million for the line. You've got roads. They're expanding roads along Foxconn.
They're designating former county highways as state highways, which raises the potential of delaying outstate projects. Go ahead, excuse me.
So the price tag keeps going up. What's been fascinating to watch of this story is when it was first announced in July, this seemed like a home run for Governor Walker of, you know, 13,000 jobs, a $10 billion investment, and all that kind of good stuff. And Democrats are even kind of like taking it back of, okay, how do we deal with it? How do we kind of respond to this? And a couple of the gubernatorial candidates first said this could be a good thing. I think I get the impression the first kind of real, like, I don't know, kind of pause of that was when we started reading the bill summary, the cost, and we found the line saying it could be 25 years before we break even.
2042.
And it was like, wow, that's a long time.
Yes.
And then the tide seemed to turn somewhat because there was that question of, is this a good deal for taxpayers? And oh, by the way, because of the way our tax code works with manufacturers, it's basically a direct subsidy to the company to pay its payroll. Now, we do that with other incentive deals, but
not,
it's like a
but
much
not
lower
at that
rate.
Percentage.
So you have that going on. So Walker's had to do a better job of selling this deal out state, especially because out in Eau Claire and La Crosse and Walker, they're going, well, okay, it's great for Racine, but what about me? And so the argument for them has become, well, all these suppliers are going to pop up and there'll be a ripple effect around Wisconsin. Now, we won't know for sure for two decades, if this thing plays out. For Walker and Republicans who backed it, they want and need to see by next summer a plant going up, people being hired, tangible evidence of, look, we have a plant going on, because Democrats keep saying, look, this manufacturer has made promises in lots of places that haven't come true. So by next summer, if there's not a plant, a foundation for a plant, walls going up,
yeah,
and you say, hey, guys, this may not be happening. Now, there was a deadline to deposit money into an account, which they missed, and said, hey, no big deal, it's going to get there.
$60 million,
but it's
deadline
a big,
missed.
Big question out there. And this is going to become a major issue in the election next fall.
Yes.
Because while Democrats at first said, I'm not sure how to deal with this, now they're saying, this and our polling that they've seen, and they've talked about other polls that we've seen from like PPP and others saying, this and Marquette is the Milwaukee area. They see an opening to say, this is a bad deal for taxpayers. And oh, by the way, if you're Harley Davidson, if you're these other Johnson, these major Wisconsin manufacturers, where's your deal? You know, why weren't you given this preferential treatment? And Dems like to, like, you recoil at the idea of, you know, using foreign, but they keep talking about a foreign company coming and getting Wisconsin tax dollars because they see it as a winning message about this. Now, next fall, it'll be the big mix of like the environment with the White House, the economy, how things are going. This be part of like that debate in November of next year.
And let's listen to a short segment of the Foxconn debate, which opened with Governor Walker on July 27, talking about these huge numbers and then some of the debate in the legislature. And anyway, the Foxconn debate.
We're going to sign a memorandum of understanding that isn't just big, it's super big. This is about Foxconn committing to investing $10 billion in the state of Wisconsin that will lead to 13,000 jobs here in the great state of Wisconsin. In return, we're committed to being a great partner, and so the state of Wisconsin in this memorandum of understanding is committing to invest and provide incentives worth $3 billion. We've seen through the reports as we prepared through this process that at least 22,000 indirect and induced jobs will be a part of this. So you can see this isn't just big, this is super big.
The governor's explanation, Mr. Speaker, was that, quote, those 13,000 jobs are no more important than the 13 jobs that helped in the small business in Green Bay or Superior or La Crosse. But here's the difference. Those 13,000 jobs weren't subsidized by the taxpayers of Wisconsin. Those jobs don't force the giveaway of hundreds of millions of dollars a year at the expense of our other state priorities. Or they don't have a payback, best case scenario, of 25 years.
And the only thing that they can talk about as some kind of a boogeyman
is the fact that we have the largest economic development project in the country. The largest foreign investment in the history of our state. And if you live in the far left world of the people on this half of the chamber, that's a bad thing. How in the world can 13,000 jobs be a negative unless you are clearly out of touch with the reality of the average, everyday working Wisconsinite?
JR, any predictions for 2018?
Yes, I will make no predictions for 2018. But this is what I'm going to watch for. If you want to know, like, because after 2016, we had such, everybody in the professional political class and the media were so off about what was going to happen with Donald Trump, right? So that has kind of, like, singed me about making predictions. But I'll tell you what I want to watch. Number one, what's the right track, wrong track number in Wisconsin in late October of next year? Watch the Marquette poll. Do people feel good about where the state is going or not? If they feel good, that's good for Governor Walker. Number two, where are President Trump's approval numbers in October of next year? If they are where they're at right now, it's not like in November of last year was a choice of him or Hillary Clinton. Now it's how do you feel about him, period. And if you feel about him is not very good, that's bad news for Republicans. I've seen stories about warning signs out there for Republicans about what's going on. Who's the Democratic nominee for governor? Mm-hmm. Who emerges? What's the message going to be? And Tammy Baldwin's campaign. You know, if you don't have a strong gubernatorial candidate from the Democratic side, can she build an operation? Because the party's had its issues, Democratic Party. Can she build an operation with her own resources to take care of that issue? Those are kind of things that I would watch in 2018 to get a better feel of, like, what's going to happen come next fall.
And as for me, predictions in 2018, I will make no predictions. JR is right. I'm Steve Walders.
I'm JR Ross.
Hey, good JR, year, Steve. Thank you for 2017. Thanks to Henry Cerugi, our house band. Take us out. All right. Thank you. That is Year in Review Rewind. Thanks.
Rewind, your Year in Review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.